Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
Coming up on the Free For All, super special senior sports boss, champion, correspondent, all-pro MVP, Matt Futterman is here to talk about his first book, Players, the story of sports money, the visionaries who fought to create a revolution. Coming up, Free For All, plus Jim Cherusmi joins us.
This is Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hey, this is Jason Gay, and this is the Free For All, and joining us live in the studio, believe it or not, America's favorite podcaster Jim Cherusmi.
How you doing, Jason?
Making a rare appearance here on the Free For All. Jim, how is your new life as an NFL correspondent?
Well, I was at draft headquarters, giant draft headquarters this past week, and it was not quite as glamorous as you would think.
Yeah, was there a food option?
There was food, but it was not as glamorous as you think. There was a lot of sitting around and listening to Mel Kiper.
Yeah.
And then kind of, you know, once speculating who the team is going to pick.
Yeah.
And then once the team picks, you kind of scramble, and then you get to ask the team why they picked who they picked. And they all think, you know, everyone is great.
So electricity was not in the air.
No. But it was funny. I mean, there was drama because at the point I was at Giant headquarters and their Tunsil, the gas mask guy, was still on the board. And the Giants didn't like acknowledge that they skipped over him, but they kind of did.
Yeah. Now, has anyone of the Giants or more importantly, the Wall Street Journal put together the fact that the Timex Center is right next to the track?
It's true. It's true. It was open that night, too, I think.
Yeah. And so is any part of Jim saying, you know what, this is kind of boring. I can just walk over right now and just do a box, you know.
But they don't have races on game day.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
so
I looked that up.
Draft night?
On draft night, perhaps.
Okay.
There was a lot of time to kill.
In other words, you may be spending an inordinate amount of time. You might want to invest in a full parking pass.
Yes.
I'm saying.
Yes.
And what kind of racing do they have there?
Harness racing.
Harness racing. Are you a fan?
I'm not a fan. I have not figured it out, but they also have thoroughbred racing a couple times a year.
Like, okay. All right. Well, Jim, I would be very disappointed if you didn't mix your passion for four-legged animals with your new passion for the NFL. And I miss you here at the Free For All, but, you know, somehow we're muddling through. Joining us in the studio, Matthew Futterman, who is the senior correspondent or whatever the hell. What are you, senior what?
Senior special guy.
Senior special guy at the Wall Street Journal.
Senior special writer for sports.
Matthew Futterman has been at the Wall Street Journal since it was in black and white. No, not that long. But he is here because he's written a new book, his first book, and it's already a sensation. Just came out. It's called Players. Not play as Jim. Players. The story of sports and money and the visionaries who fought to create a revolution. Already some extraordinary notices for it. You got blurbs on the back from the likes of Jim Nance. Jim Nance, a tradition like no other. Jim Nance giving a quote talking about how great Players is. Also Don Van Natta, who is the great investigatory journalist from the ESPN network. Billy Beane, the star of Moneyball, on the cover. Matt, Players.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to write this bad boy?
About 3 years.
3 years.
Well, 2 years and then a year of rewriting.
Right?
Okay. Good writing is rewriting, right?
Yeah, never heard of that.
I want to pat you guys both on the back for having completed books without taking a hiatus from this Wall Street Journal gig, unlike some other people we know.
Unlike the editor of the Wall Street Journal's
book
section, who took time off. You know, we've ruined it for other people, like, you know, with our workaholic.
Yes. So my theory about that was when I was asking permission to write this book.
Yeah.
I didn't in 2012. I had been at the Journal for 4 years.
Yeah.
2012, you might remember, well, actually, you could say this about any time in the last, like, 20 years. Not the greatest time for print journalism. and I didn't feel like going to my employer and telling them how easily they could live without me for 6 months or nine months or a year, how easy it would be to do that sort of thing.
I thought that would be a bad idea.
Yeah.
You know why we feel that way? Because we're not entitled millennials like Jim over here.
That's
okay?
That's true.
You know, we
That's
really
true.
Do feel there's something, if you're born, you know, during the war like we were, that you feel like you're going to come back to work and there's going to be somebody sitting on your desk.
Absolutely.
You know?
And Jim, that thing you said about draft night at the Giants, not that glamorous. There's another word for it. It's called sports writing.
But the story of players, and there was a really excellent excerpt in the Journal now a couple weeks ago, is really sort of the most important story in sports of the last 50 or so years, which is the incredible professionalization that has happened. I mean, we are now, you know, quite a long way removed from the era of amateurism or even thinking of sports as, you know, a middle-class profession.
Unless you work for the NCAA.
This is true. This is very true. There are still aspects of it. And let's be fair, there are some professional sports in which, you know, people are barely eking out livings. But the extraordinary growth of money in sport has, you know, really changed the way that we watch the game, that we feel about the game. And you were able to sort of drill deep to what was sort of the key moments. You know, we think about stuff like, okay, Curt Flood, and we think about that sort of seismic moment, free agency in baseball and players being able to determine their direction. But what is, if there's an overlooked moment in your mind as to what really galvanized the players' revolution, what was it?
Well, one of the things in writing the book was to dispel with some of these supposedly big moments, which really weren't huge moments at all.
Is Curt Flood one of those that's not as big as we think?
Well, Curt Flood lost.
Yeah.
So that, it sort of raised the awareness about the issue, but it didn't really do all that much.
Yeah.
And in fact, at the time, the people who were running the Players Union, Marvin Miller, he really didn't want Flood to go to court about the thing because he knew the case was a loser.
Yeah.
He knew that he was going to have to get the Supreme Court to overturn precedent and an opinion that was written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, one of the giants of the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court hates to do things like that.
Yeah.
So he was discouraged from that. So that's just one example of it. But, you know, what I really wanted to do was I wanted to try and explain how we got here. And by here, I mean to the point where sports is this, like, massive, inspirational thing that brings us great joy, but also is sort of crass and over-commercialized and drives us crazy at times.
Right. Like and everything we love.
Yeah, sort of. But, you know, so how did we get here? And, you know, and in addition to that, I've sort of made a career out of trying to draw the connections between how the money gets spent off the field and how that filters through and affects the competition on the field.
Got it.
So you put those two things together and go back to what through doing a lot of reporting, figured was the beginning, which was this guy named Mark McCormick, who comes on the scene in 1959, a bored Cleveland lawyer who's a really good golfer, qualified twice for the U.S. Open, and wants to try and make money in sports. And his idea is to sign a bunch of golfers up for exhibition rounds at local country clubs before they play in a tournament in, you know, Orlando or Palm Beach or wherever they are that weekend. And one of the people he signs up is Arnold Palmer. And Arnold Palmer signs on for this. The whole venture is a bit of a disaster. A year into it, McCormick is sort of begging Palmer to represent all of his other interests, and Palmer says, you know what, if you want to do that, you got to fire everybody else and just represent me. And McCormick says, okay, I'll do that. You're the best golfer in the world right now. So he agrees to do that, although he kind of lies to him because he never stops working for Gary Player, but he doesn't tell him that. And so they go to work, and that's really the sort of aha moment, because he gets him out of this incredibly exploitative contract with Wilson, and then he builds Arnold Palmer into the first modern sports entrepreneur.
Yeah.
You know, Arnold Palmer has a logo. You know, nobody has had a logo before.
Yeah.
Arnold Palmer goes on reality. They create reality TV eventually.
Just to interrupt, I'm blanking here. I was about to say Bear, but that's Nicholas. What is Palmer's logo?
It's an umbrella.
It's an umbrella?
It's this umbrella logo. Right.
But see, I'm definitely old enough to remember Quaker State commercials with Arnold Palmer and so on. And, you know, that was not analogous to golf. And this was a guy who was clearly could be a pitchman for things that were not endemic to sports.
There was an Arnold Palmer dry cleaners. I mean, there was literally...
like a chain?
Yeah, there was Arnold Palmer dry cleaners. Wow. And one of the reasons it stopped because the other players started making fun of him in the locker room because he would come into the locker room and they'd say, like, Arnold, can you press my pants for me?
So he didn't like
that all that much.
Was golf ripe for this kind of potential? You know, was there something about the sort of free agent nature of it that...
Well, first of all, these guys were independent contractors. Yeah. The second thing is that they didn't necessarily have to take anybody else's part of the pie. Okay, yeah. In baseball, it was hard because you had the league and you had the owners pushing back. Yeah. There was really no opposition in golf. Right. The biggest opposition that Palmer faced was, like I said before, was the Wolfson Sporting Goods Company that signed him up in 1954, renews his contract in 1957, slips in a provision in there that gives them the right to renew the contract essentially through his prime playing years without him realizing that because at the time his wife was his business manager and... she wasn't a lawyer and wasn't doing things like reading cover letters to contracts. And he was making they were paying him $7,000 a year and they were telling him that, you know, we can cut this at any moment. So if you throw out your back, like we're done with you. Right. And oh, by the way, we can ask you to return all of the clubs, balls, and golf bags that we've given you. I mean, that's literally in the contract. So it's like this horrendous contract. Eventually they get out of that and there it is, and you know, so they say the rest is history, but he becomes the model that gets copied in all of golf.
When does television really start to exert its influence on the way this all goes?
Well, it begins a little bit with Palmer, because what McCormick does is McCormick figures out that television is sort of going to be the gas that's going to drive the engine. And so he also he had Gary Player all along. He signs Jack Nicklaus and he creates this thing called Big Three Golf, which is they fly to exotic locales, play the golf course, they tape them playing a round, which is supposedly a competitive round, and it often took 2 days for them to complete one round because the camera equipment was
reloading
so clunky
and
everything, and they're trying to get all the shots. But at the end of those 2 days, they would have a match to show on television, and they could sell that, and they sold it all around the world. And so that's sort of the beginning of it. As you move through the 60s, you get into the Rune Arledge era.
Sure.
And Rune Arledge in the late 60s sort of discovers how to broadcast the Olympics and introduces the concept of storytelling.
Storytelling and star making.
Yes, storytelling and star making.
And so the Rune Arledge theory was that you could not interest an audience in, you know, strange sports like curling and, you know, even ski jumping, whatever.
Gymnastics was a big one.
Sort of building some starcraft behind it. And in the same way, like, you know, a movie promoter would do, you make stars out of people, and that, of course, creates celebrity, and celebrity then becomes...
Right, the Bulgarian gymnast who's awaiting to take this next vault. It's really important that the announcer knows and that they have a little clip of her, and everybody knows that her mother has cancer back in Sofia, Bulgaria, and she's dedicated this vault to her mother, and all of a sudden, you know, that vault becomes a moment in life and not just a vault where she's trying to win a medal. So there's that. But, you know, at the same time, I think television gets almost too much credit in this story.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason I wrote it the way I did, which was to focus on the players, because I don't think television is able to exert its influence if sports had remained the way they were. And why I say that is, you know, you bring money into sports, and this was what made Mark McCormick really smart, and this was sort of his grand vision, which was that if we can get more money into the players, into the pockets of the athletes, they're going to have more time to train and practice. They're not going to have second jobs, which a lot of them did at that time.
Yeah, sure.
Okay? And so they're going to have more time to practice. They're going to get better at what they do, and the competition is going to get better. And if the competition is better, people are going to want to pay more money to see it, and people are going to want to pay more money to put it on television. And once that money filters through the system, it's going to get back to the players, and they're going to start making even more money. And so there's going to be a lot more competition for their jobs.
Yeah.
So this filters all the way down to the levels of, you know, kids and athletic development, and the talent pool gets broadened. And then the whole sort of thing snowballs on itself, and it cycles. So sports had to get to a point where it was good television before television could really juice sports the way it has.
I want to ask.
And I guess
you
I shouldn't use
things.
The word juice.
That's okay. Juice probably played a role in all this too. We're going to take a quick break to pay for our sponsors because we are such players here at the Free For All, and then we'll be back with Matthew Futterman, author of Players.
Hi, I'm Paul Vigna. If you do not subscribe to the Money Beat podcast, you are going to feel worse than a short seller on the day of a big rally. Go to iTunes and wsj.com/podcasts. You want to sign up for this one.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
We're back here with Matthew Futterman, senior special correspondent supreme for the Wall Street Journal and the author of the just published nonfiction sensation Players, the story of sports and money and the visionaries who fought to create a revolution. Matt, not to jump around too much here, but can the argument be made in U.S. sport? We look out there and see the LeBron James, I don't know what his salary is this year, but it's, you know, $25 million or so. And Tom Brady's making $20 million. Are those guys actually underpaid, undervalued in terms of what their salary structure is? I know they make oodles of money from endorsements and other things, but are they actually underpaid a little bit?
I would say they probably are underpaid, and here's why. Because for the most part, they are the one essential ingredient of this. In the same way that if Brad Pitt's in a movie, nobody's going to see that movie because of, you know, the producer of this.
Like, I love railroad dramas.
or because the, you know, the studio right. head is awesome.
Right.
You know, people go to see the stars.
Yeah.
And that's
especially
what,
in something like basketball.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, you could argue that, you know, they're the one thing that if you remove, the whole thing falls apart, yeah. which is sort of why I've always wondered why the NBA players have had such a hard time in recent years, especially yeah. in their contract negotiations, in the collective bargaining agreements, because yeah. it would be so easy for them to set up to say, you know what, we're out of here. We're going to go start our own league.
Yeah.
There are so many arenas in the country.
Yeah.
All they need is essentially LeBron and Steph Curry and Durant and maybe one or two other guys to say, yeah, come with us. And then everyone would fall into line.
Yeah.
And then they could just do it.
Yeah.
Why don't they?
I think they haven't been organized enough to do it yet. It's a real, it's the fault of the former leader, Billy Hunter, who was a crook, basically, and that they never sort of got organized in this way. It takes a couple of years of planning to do something, to get yourself to the point where you can do that when crunch time comes.
Now,
so that's why it hasn't happened.
Matt, I know that you are a tennis guy. You play the sport. You like the sport. There was a interesting dialogue earlier this year coming out of Indian Wells where some comments were made about, you know, whether or not female players should be grateful for, you know, riding in the wake of Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, and it caused an uproar. But tennis has had a very, you know, as close to equal a pay structure as we've seen between men's sports and women's sports, at least at the big events. And what was your feeling about watching that go down? And was there any validity to the kinds of things that were being said?
I think in the last, I think in the last 10 years, tennis has, you know, the men have really dominated. You know, the big four has been the thing that's been the big attraction. Except last year, there was this thing where, you know, minor thing, Serena Williams was, you know, going for a Grand Slam.
No, but that was not a small thing.
I mean,
I'm being facetious here, of course.
Yeah. You know, it was huge.
That final,
right.
which she didn't end up being in, sold
right.
out before the men's.
Yeah. Right. So, I think a lot of these things are cyclical. I know from an aesthetic standpoint, I often like. There have been periods where I've much preferred watching women's tennis to
sure.
men's tennis
yeah.
Because of the shot making. You know, there were those eras where men's tennis was just all serve and no return. So
yeah.
I think it probably goes in waves. You know, in terms of the equal pay argument, there's that whole thing where, you know, the women only play 2 out of 3 and the men only play 3 out of 5. So should they get paid for more work? And yeah, my answer to that has always been, oh, just let the men pay 2 out of 3.
Me too. I mean, seriously. I mean, yeah, especially keep the pay, when it's midnight at Forest Hills.
Keep the pay equal and keep the amount of sets equal too.
For women's sport, you know, we've seen this repeatedly in areas outside of tennis. We're seeing it now at USA Soccer, the U.S. women's national team, you know, in an action against USA Soccer, and USA Soccer in an action against the women's national team. How do you see that bearing out?
Well, so the women's soccer team is the epilogue to the book, because I think it's fairly clear to anyone who reads my stuff, they're kind of my favorite team to cover in a lot of ways.
And also, you were brilliantly Nostradamus here, and you knew this was going to be a big scandal, just as you.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Perfectly.
Right. And I sort of write that is the women's sport is the next great battlefield, and the women's soccer team is the next great battlefield. Yeah. And that, you know, other than a few women in the world, a couple of tennis players, a couple of golfers, you know, the women's professional sports has really lagged behind men's. In terms of the women specifically, you know, I think the lesson of sports over the last 50 years in the men's professional leagues, and this is going to be a hard one for the women to swallow, is that there comes a point where you don't play, and you give up something really big in order to show that you're serious.
So a strike, an action.
You got to take an action. I mean, what turned tennis was not it going open in 68.
But
it was
Billie Jean and Rosie Casals walked away.
And Stan Smith blew off Wimbledon.
He was a defending champion.
He was a defending champion. He's sort of the central character in the tennis chapter here because he never won another Grand Slam.
And he was playing. Stan's getting his due. People think of him as a sneaker guy. He's an essential man in tennis.
He was playing the best tennis of his life during the 6 months leading up to that Wimbledon. Yeah. And look, nobody gives up the Wimbledon crown like that. But he realized that, you know, his friend Nikki Pilich, who didn't actually like all that much, was kind of a blowhard, was getting screwed by the International Tennis Federation. And if the players were ever going to be able to be treated as equal partners, they had to make a stand. And if Nikki was going to get suspended for what he did, which was not play a Davis Cup tie and play a professional tournament instead, if he could get suspended for that, then, you know, they all could be suspended at any time for doing what they wanted to do. And so he blew it off. And when the defending champion says, I'm not playing, most of the next 80 players decide they're not going to play either. Yeah. And that's what made it. And the baseball, you know, the baseball players missed 50 games in 1981. Yeah. They missed the World Series in 1994. I mean, they gave up tens and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah. And at some point, the women's soccer team probably is going to have to do something like this. I mean, they probably should, if they're getting pushback, which they are from U.S. soccer for their equal pay, they really ought to just blow off the Olympics.
Yeah.
I mean, they just ought to say, look, go ahead. And no one would cross their picket
line.
People
on the outside of this issue look at the dispute and say, like, what's the big deal? It's not really even a crazy amount of money that's being asked. It's just equal pay. Is it really going to bring U.S. soccer to its knees if it has to actually do this?
Well, I think that U.S. soccer is really worried about this precedent of not having their pay connected with the revenues that the team brings in. Now, the women argue that, you know, we bring in plenty of revenues. Our World Cup final was the most watched soccer game in the history of the U.S.
But if the TV fees were not comparable to what the men's TV fees were.
Right, so people are not watching the other non-U.S. games of the Women's World Cup.
Yep.
So there's that. But having said that, and so they say U.S. Soccer says they want it market based. But here's the problem with that argument is that U.S. Soccer doesn't function in a competitive market.
Yeah.
If I'm American and I don't want to play for U.S. Soccer, there's no other U.S. soccer team that I can go play for and say, you know what? And so they have a monopoly on this thing, which I think, sort of compels them to not have this and not have this completely tied to market economics.
Now, you know, a very dear topic of mine and here on the Free for All with Jim is the idea of a bubble in sports. And I'll ask this as a two-parter. One is, do you believe there is a sports bubble in terms of the TV economy and what people, networks are paying rights fees? I mean, these things are the extraordinary television contract that the NBA is about to walk into, the ridiculous amount that networks renew for the NFL. We're talking the big sports here, you know, college football, basketball. There's great, you know, suspicion that the way that television is rapidly changing is going to make networks, and they're already kind of doing this, reassess how much they're paying for these things. And if they do have to reassess and if they offer less, does someone else just pop up like a Facebook or Google and, you know, be the new crazy buyer? Or will these sports and these players have to, you know, take some haircuts here financially and players be a little bit lowercase players?
I think the haircuts probably are in the offing eventually. If no one can come up with another delivery mode that is as profitable and as guaranteed as the cable fees from the regional sports networks. I mean, that's really been the golden goose over the last 15 years.
And that's been stuff like, you know, the YES Network here in New York City that has this ridiculous deal with the Yankees and Dodgers
right.
in L.A.
Yeah.
But millennials are watching streaming. I mean, that, I think that's the next avenue they're looking
right,
for.
Right, but the problem is you can't put it this way. I mean, the baseball contracts prohibit you. I mean, they prohibit you from selling games
in the local
over the top or streaming them. You know, a Yankee fan can't really watch the Yankees, you know, sitting on the beach on his iPad.
Also, Jim, I don't know if you know this, but you would if you worked at a newspaper, but digital ads are not as valuable as television traditional ads.
Right. So that's a problem. And it, you know, they, you know, younger people do not have cable subscriptions, and if cable and if they're not going to buy the cable subscriptions, then the cable companies and the owners of the regional sports networks are not going to be able to afford to pay the teams the rights fees that they've paid.
Where is this going to be felt first? Do you think it'll be felt first in team sports, or will we see it like in events, like, you know, I don't know, U.S. Open or something?
No, I think
that
the big events are the big events with cachet are probably okay,
because they're a draw.
They're sort of a one-time thing.
Yeah.
I think it's more felt at the team level, and maybe not the Yankees. But yeah, the Yankees, because right now the Yankees aren't on Comcast in New Jersey. It's a million people. You know, it's about a million.
Or the Dodgers
fans.
Situation.
And the Dodgers, only 40% of LA can actually see the Dodgers. And the companies that aren't carrying the Dodgers channel are doing just fine.
Yeah.
You know, they're not suffering any losses.
Right, right.
So Comcast added subscribers in the quarter, in this most recent quarter, when the YES Network was running these ads saying, drop Comcast or else you won't get your Yankees.
I mean, there's an analog here to the newspaper business in that, you know, there's a lot of voodoo in sports about, like, you know, like, sports being sort of a loss leader to develop your other programming. You know, networks used to overpay for football because, okay, you could promote your dumb sitcoms and your movie of the week and all that kind of stuff. Now it's a little bit more like football is your number one thing. It's your best product. You know, it's actually the most rated thing you have. But what happened in newspapers is it wasn't like this sort of like, there was this sort of like theory as to what was important, what people read. Now we know exactly what's important and what people read. We know exactly how long they read it for. And TV now is in this space where they know exactly how many people are not watching. And, you know, the theory behind something like ESPN for a long time was not getting people who love sports to pay for ESPN. It was getting the oodles of people who didn't give a crap about sports to pay for ESPN on top of that. And once you eliminate those people, Where's the money?
Your bill the monthly fee for ESPN, if it was just people who are watching ESPN, had to pay it. If it was a user fee, essentially, the monthly fee for ESPN would have to, I think, at least triple or maybe quadruple in order to make up for the losses. If we went to an a la carte world where you got to choose which channels you wanted, choosing ESPN instead of costing you $8 a month right now would cost, I think, $30 or $40 a month. I think it would be worth it, though. I mean, I would buy it because, you know, ESPN has a lot of stuff on it. I don't think ESPN is the problem here, by the way. I think ESPN, you know, has tons of college football. There's every major event at this – almost every major event at this point. The problem is the YES Networks of the world, yeah, which have Yankee games, and that's it. And there's nothing else to watch with the Yankee games. There's that Celtics-only channel up in New England.
CSN, I mean, New England.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, okay.
Which I keep thinking is Crosby, Stills, and Nash New England every time I see the logo.
That would be cool. Maybe it should be Celtics and Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Who was the most fun person? This is our last question because we're getting the hook, I see, from the production booth. But who is the most fun person to speak to for this book? Who is the person you never could have stopped talking to?
I could listen to Bill Bradley for a while.
Really?
And that's a sentimental thing on my part, okay, just because, yeah, you know, he was such a sort of iconic figure, yeah, in New York in, yeah, the 70s.
It was a little bit of a problem in the 96 presidential election.
Yeah, that didn't go
what
so
well.
What
is he up to these days?
He's an investment banker, an advisor with Allen & Company. And, you know, I desperately wanted to ask him the question that I asked him in the book, was, which is, do you feel bad about that when you set that record for the most points in an NCAA tournament, you did it by running up the score on poor Wichita State in a game there. You completely blew them out, and it was a consolation game. It didn't even count, and you scored 26 points in the final 9 minutes when your team was already winning by 30. Do you feel a little bad about that? And he was really he felt a little glum and guilty, and he said, you know, that was just the joy of shooting. And that sort of is what it sort of summed up for me.
Well, one of the things I've always admired you, if I can be sincere for a minute, is that you have been, you're always the person who will ask the tough question. I've seen you do it face-to-face numerous times with people who are usually unaccustomed to answering those questions and certainly not getting them face-to-face. It's one of the reasons why you are a great, great reporter, not just a sports reporter, but a great reporter in general. Congratulations on this book. Congratulations on just getting it done, but congratulations on all the raves for
it. Thank you.
It's called Players, the Story of Sports and Money and the Visionaries Who Fought to Create a Revolution. Matthew Futterman, the book is available on Amazon. I know you're not allowed to. You have to be sort of like neutral, right? You have to say you can get it here, you get it there, get it on Amazon. Wherever great books are sold. But I'll say it's there on the Amazon. It's there on the iBooks. It's there on Barnes & Noble. Matt Futterman, Players, read it today. Thanks for joining us on the Free For All. I'm Jason Gay. As always, you can subscribe to us on iTunes and wherever fine podcasts are sold.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.